Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Cases on Hold, number 56. Thanks for all of you who've been along with us for the ride since the beginning. Hope you've been having a good time. My name is Antonia Chen. I am deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and we have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
Thank you for joining us. The opinions are our own. They are not of JBJS, the editorial board, or anyone else. This is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. Get your learn on. Miller Review Course for step one, step two, all these important tests that you need to do to pass the board. So get to Miller Review if you haven't done it yet. Now we're going straight into it. Top of the pile, What's New in Sports Medicine by Thompson. It is permanently free. Are Uniformed, Shaw, permanently free as well.
It seemed like that should be more of a title.
I know, right? Well, if you also look,
Our uniformed of what?
Those who have represented us. Yeah, it's true. The uniformed and the proud. How's that? Anyway, the American Association of Latino Orthopedic Surgeons, Our History, Achievements, and Future Goals by Escalera. And now we go into our headlines. Lead us off there, Dr. Schoenfeld, about the impact of unplanned reoperation following adult spinal deformity surgery, a prospective longitudinal cohort study with five-year follow-up by Police et al.
So this is a study from the European Spine Study Group. Adult spinal deformity surgery, the need for it is increasing due to the aging demographic. The enthusiasm for it is increasing due to a number of studies that have shown, you know, dramatic improvements in health-related quality of life, activities of daily living, physical function. These are not benign surgeries, however. They're very extensive surgeries in populations of patients that tend to be older and have lower physiologic reserves with an associated higher risk for complications, including infection, wound breakdown, mechanical failure, near-term mortality, nerve injury, spinal cord injury. So these have to be done by very experienced teams at hospitals that are used to managing these types of patients, sometimes, you know, with extensive or at least more extended length of stay in the parlance of our times. And we, you know, the outcome of the surgery can definitely be negatively impacted if some adverse event or a serious adverse event that then needs further surgery, unplanned reoperation occurs. And that's what they wanted to look at here in terms of charting the natural history for these patients who had unplanned reoperation. Where were they at 2 and 5 years follow-up? Sometimes that adverse event is going to create a ceiling effect in terms of the maximal benefit that these patients can derive from these types of procedures. So they used linear models controlling for baseline data and surgical characteristics. I don't necessarily love that approach because there's a lot about these things that really makes them, they're not exactly linear. People like to treat them that way, but there's a lot of sort of guardrails on either side of sort of the spectrum in which patients are going to exist, both who have the condition to warrant these surgeries and where they are after these surgeries. But setting that, you know, sort of caveat aside, they had 96 patients, that's 30% of their population, who had 165 unplanned reoperations. So almost 2 unplanned procedures per patient in this cohort. And, you know, I think it's very telling that even still, well, and then at 5 years, it was a, you know, similar numbers. And even still, many of these patients were able to achieve reasonable outcomes despite these, you know, very serious adverse events. The most common cause was a mechanical complication, which is typically like hardware failure or, you know, uncoupling of the rod from the pedicle screws or something to that effect, or surgical site infections, which were close to 1 in 5 for an infection. Also, you know, very reasonable numbers that sort of match with other data, other large-scale series that have been done in this context. So there's good face validity there. And, you know, I think the findings are very sound and very interesting and informative. So a post-operative unplanned reoperation was associated with a lower improvement in health-related quality of life. That's, again, consistent with, you know, the table that was set at the beginning of this. These patients have these events, oftentimes there's going to be a lower ceiling for them as compared to someone without the event. That's probably goes for like any kind of surgery, right? Like when someone has a total knee replacement, and then they get an infection, then it gets stiff, then they get another one, then they can't clear it, then they get an amputation. Obviously, that outcome is not where it is for someone who had a total knee with no problem.
Right. Big differences.
But the association did not diminish over time and was really driven by the number of reoperations, not the intensity, the magnitude of the reoperation. And if you were able to effectively resolve the adverse event, then that also reduced the impact of the unplanned procedure. So I think that's really good information that's very valuable and important for the community. It's good evidence that supports, you know, the management of these patients who have difficult complications following these already difficult procedures. Now, the one thing that I will say is that they called this level 2 evidence, which this is, you know, however the data is collected, this is a post hoc look at these outcomes. It's really just sort of a clinical epidemiology. You're just following, you know, these patients along and then documenting when they have these events, and then how they're managed is driven by selection, indication, cluster, expertise bias, all these things. I would say this is really level 4 evidence around these patients. I wouldn't call it level 2.
I agree with that. So something to think about for all of you there who are writing out papers, be careful with your levels of evidence. So my study is looking a little bit different, not 5-year follow-up, but we're looking at the hand now. So provision of a home-based video-assisted therapy program is not inferior to in-person hand therapy after thumb carpal metacarpal arthroplasty by Barrett et al. There's a commentary on this as well too, so you don't have to take my words on this. Interestingly enough, comparing in-person therapy with video-based therapy has been done in many specialties in orthopedics already. This is one that happens to be looking at thumb metacarpal arthroplasty. So this study looks at asynchronous video-only therapy. So there are 3 different types of therapy, I would say. There's in-person therapy. There's therapy where you're looking at a therapist by video, but it's telemedicine and not someone physically touching you. And there's asynchronous where here's a video, we're sending it to you, and you just do the exercises. So compared to this asynchronous video-only therapy to in-person therapy after thumb CMC arthroplasty, and it was a prospective randomized controlled trial, non-inferior design. It was a single site, but it only contained 58 patients. And that's because they did an interim analysis here. So they looked at primary thumb CMC arthroplasty without an implant. And this was done June 2021 to February 2023, which brings me to my first point of this is post-pandemic. So I wonder if part of this is driven also by pandemic ideas, because the idea of going in person scared a lot of people. So more and more people wanted to do kind of a remote telemedicine-like option, potentially. Ineligible patients were non-native English speakers, those undergoing bilateral revision procedures or implant arthroplasty, and those undergoing concomitant procedures except for carpal metacarpal arthrodesis, carpal tunnel release, or thumb trigger finger release. Both of these sort of therapies started at 4 weeks postoperatively. For the in-person, they had 7 sessions with a certified hand therapist once a week for 30 minutes per week, 30 minutes per session. The downside is that the therapy treatment times were recorded for all inpatient visits, but outside video utilization was not monitored, and time spent in watching videos in the group was not monitored or recorded. So we have no idea if the group that did the video therapy actually did the therapy by video. And 2, we have no idea if the patients who did the in-person therapy actually did video therapy on their own outside. The primary outcome was a patient-reported outcome. It's the patient-reported outcome measurement information system, PROMIS, upper extremity score. They did it pre-op, 12 weeks, and 1 year post-op. Physical function testing included grip and pinch strength, as well as thumb and radial volar abduction. The sample size was initially powered for 134 patients and accounted for attrition, but they did do an interim analysis to stop the study if the control group was found to be superior or if the experimental group was found to be non-inferior. It was 50 women and 8 men at 12-week follow-up. At 1-year follow-up, it was 54 patients with a mean age of 61 years. Of these, 96.6% were white, 3.4% were black, and they said 13.8% were Hispanic. Unless there's a lot of overlap, the numbers didn't really match up there when it came to ethnicity. There are no significant differences in outcome. The differences between groups was 1.5 with this PROMIS upper extremity score at 12 weeks and 2.2 at 1 year. And the NCID for this scoring system or for this PROMS was 4.1. So it didn't reach the threshold of MCID or minimally clinical important difference. There was no difference in grip strength or other cost measurements. They did say that they only put this in the conclusion and the abstract. They didn't put this in the results section. They did look at where the patients lived. And so because of that, they said there was a cost savings potentially where the group that did the video therapy saved on average 201 miles in travel. So that's a cost savings there. It would be nice to have included more information, at least in my book here. So they looked at 202 patients who were eligible, but only 58% of the patients, 58 patients enrolled. So not a high percentage of patients. And my curiosity is to why those other patients didn't enroll. We had done a previous study looking at video therapy versus inpatient therapy. And the reason that people didn't enroll is because they didn't want to do in-person therapy. So interestingly enough, it actually drove them to not participate in the study because they could be randomized to get in-person therapy, which they did not want.
Yeah, I think those are the most salient points in terms of a critique for that particular effort. Definitely, you know, potential confounding in some respects in terms of, you know, motivations and interest. Always cautious when something is said to be non-inferior. It doesn't mean just as good. It means not as bad. Like,
like non-inferior.
Yeah.
Not too bad. Just a little bad, a little worse.
In today's day and age, you know, for a motivated individual, it makes sense.
It does make a lot of sense, I think. And again, I think a lot of patients personally do a lot of exercises on their own anyway. So whether it be in person, be it video, you know, you can't take that into account. So what I would love to be able to know is, you know, what's the threshold, right? How much exercise do you need to do to achieve the MCID, for example? Not the difference between the two, but that's a totally different study. So at least this kind of says, look, telemedicine visits or video visits are very useful so that those therapists can be freed up to do other things in their time as opposed to CMC arthroplasty patients. Moving on to the next one, the Your Case is on Hold featurette, the natural history of quantitative fatty infiltration and 3D muscle volume after non-operative treatment of symptomatic rotator cuff tears, a prospective MRI study of 79 patients. By the way, Hotricher et al., and there's a commentary on this. The people who have rotator cuff tears typically ask things like, will I get worse over time? If I treat this non-operatively, will it become worse? So this study quantitatively analyzed the supraspinatus fat muscle fatty infiltration and volume at the initial presentation and after a three-month minimum course of conservative management, looking at 79 shoulders. So patients got two MRI scans, obviously before the non-operative treatment at the time of diagnosis, and then you know at a minimum of 3 months afterwards. And they use a six-point Dixon sequences. And they use the fat fraction within the supraspinatus muscle on three sagittal slices. And they took the mean. So the fat percentage was fat signal over fat signal plus water signal times 100%. And they defined this is a fatty infiltration supraspinatus muscle. The advanced was defined as greater than 8%. Pathological was greater than 13.5%. And relevant progression was defined as 4.5% increase in this fatty infiltration scale. They looked at muscle volume, tear location, size, and gluteal grade, 1, 2, and 3, 3 being worse, and 72.2% had a normal fatty infiltration in the supraspinatus muscle. But 16.5% had advanced fatty infiltration, and 11.4% had pathological fatty infiltration of the supraspinatus muscle at their initial scan. So most people had normal scans to start off with, but there were some with advanced and pathological ones. Of these 79 shoulders, 11 shoulders showed a 4.5 increase in fatty infiltration at approximately 19 months. 17 shoulders had a greater than 5 millimeter loss of volume at about 18 months. And then 5 tears with initially normal or advanced fatty infiltration turned pathological over the 3 month time frame at minimum for the follow-up. But significantly higher medial lateral tear size. So the patients who had this had significantly higher initial medial lateral tear size, less volume, more fatty infiltration, and increased progression of this fatty infiltration. And they identified three risk factors. This is the take-home message of this group, of this paper. The three risk factors for relevant FI progression quantified on the initial MRI were greater than 20 millimeters medial lateral tear size, greater than 9.9 fatty infiltration, and greater than 17 millimeter anterior-posterior tear size. Now, these were the thresholds that were associated with tear progression. And it was 19 times higher for, again, that 20 millimeter, 17.5% times higher for that 9.9 fatty infiltration, and 8 times higher than for a 17 millimeter anterior-posterior tear size. If you had all three of these present, you had a 91% chance of a 4.5 progression of fatty infiltration within a mean of 19 months. Now, that was a lot of numbers I threw at you. And it was actually interesting information when you look at MRIs, because most of the time we don't get repeat MRIs, right? We get the first MRI and we treat patients either non-operatively, whether it be physical therapy, cortisone injections, things like that. And then you reassess them clinically later on. And that's my hard part about this study, is that there was a lot of interesting radiographic information and potentially predictive information from an MRI standpoint if you were to get that prior to assessing a patient. But that said, there's not a lot of clinical data here. Right? What does this mean clinically? Like, let's say you have this huge tear size and you've progressed, right? Your fatty infiltration has gotten worse. Does that mean your function is worse, right? Does that mean you can't do certain activities? Does that mean your patient reported output outcome scores are different? Things like that, that's not assessed in this study, right? So there is no tie to clinical meaningfulness in this study. That's a little bit hard for me, because just because my fatty infiltration is completely infiltrated, let's say I'm nearly 100% fatty infiltration, but I can still raise my arm up and still do the activity of daily living that I need, then it doesn't matter to me as much.
Certainly, they wanted to do this prospective study. However, it ended up being they only included 79 patients. When you're doing a study like this, I would expect when you're planning a study like this that you sort of have an idea around what the, we'll say for this particular study, what's the incidence of fatty infiltration that you're going to be seeing. And you kind of have to play off of that for your enrollment, as well as the number of factors that you're going to include in your predictive model, your risk factor analysis that they're calling. That's really where the biggest concerns around this come into play. With just 79 patients, I question that there's an adequate representation of the universe of patients with these rotator cuff tears with sufficient numbers of the various iterations to really model these effects in a useful way. From just a pure method standpoint, when you're talking about logistic regression and it's a yes-no, you want 20 events for every variable you're going to include. So in looking at their table five, they have about, depending on how we'll give them the benefit of the doubt, we'll go off of like just what's listed, not the subset analyses, which could be factored in as well. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 for the intercept. So you need 200. You need 200 events. They had 11 events. So that gives me a lot of pause. I think certainly the concept is interesting. The fact that they examine these patients prospectively, so everyone is being, imaged the same way, that eliminates some issues around confounding. I feel like this is like an interesting study in the radiology space. And as you say, probably not so much from the standpoint of an orthopedic surgeon. As far as the risk factor analysis as they advertise it, I think that that's a pretty weak proposition.
Agreed. So it's just nice to have that data, I guess, but it's not going to change what we do.
And recognize that what they're finding may not perform the same in your set of patients with this condition.
Exactly. A condition that I do not assess regularly. Thank you. So moving on to our honorable mentions. We have the development of a Murin anterior, inner body, and posterior lateral spinal fusion technique. This is by Morse et al. There are actually no mouse models for anterior fusion techniques. Talking to my spine guy here, this I did not know. So this study evaluated and developed a murine and anterior, interbody, and posterior lateral fusion models, and they demonstrated fusion rates of 83.3% in the anterior interbody model and 100% in the posterior lateral model. So this model could be used for studying the molecular and cellular mechanisms mediating spinal fusion. So if you're a basic scientist, this is good information for you.
When Gary Busey wants to pull out your murine system, here you go.
That's a problem. Or it's a good thing. Lucky you. A rapid MRI protocol for the evaluation of acute pediatric musculoskeletal infections, eliminating contrast and decreasing anesthesia, scan time, and hospital length of stay, and charges. By Chan et al., there's a visual summary for this. The good news is I just read the entire conclusion of the article right there. This is a single center retrospective study of children undergoing evaluation for musculoskeletal infection before and after this implementation of a rapid MRI protocol. There were 60 patients in the traditional cohort and 68 patients in the rapid cohort. In patients evaluated for musculoskeletal infection, the rapid MRI protocol eliminated contrast and minimized anesthesia while improving MRI access and decreased scan and interpretation times, hospital length of stay, and hospital charges. The author stated that the rapid MRI protocol had high sensitivity for diagnosing musculoskeletal infection and a low rate of image failure, but actually didn't report a sensitivity number in the manuscript. Now, note this is just for children because adults, you don't necessarily need anesthesia to do MRIs, hopefully. And strengthening quality measurement to predict success for total knee arthroplasty results from a nationally represented total knee arthroplasty cohort by Zhang et al. This is a question of how to improve patient-reported outcomes in total knee replacement, specifically using the CUS-JR. It's adding a baseline CUS-JR prompt score to the CUS-JR using a nationally represented cohort. This specifically used FORCE-TJR, which stands for Function and Outcomes Research for Comparative Effectiveness in Total Joint Replacement, founded by the University of Massachusetts, right around the corner, improved its predictive power, eliminating the ceiling and floor effects and mispredictions for readily identifiable patient subgroups. The enhanced model neither favored nor discouraged care for those with greater knee dysfunction and required no new data collection because CUS-JR scores preoperatively, or a baseline score, should always already be there. So adding this in can be really helpful, especially as we have a mandate going forward from CMS to collect more paired PROMs, meaning you have to get it before surgery and after surgery, approximately 1 year after surgery. So this can be really relevant as we collect more PROMs going forward. The next one is prospective validation of the spinal cord shape classification system in the prediction of intraoperative neuromonitoring data loss, assessing the risk of spinal cord data loss during spinal deformity correction by Bakashishian. And there's an infographic and it's free for 30 days. This is a prospective cohort study of patients undergoing spinal deformity correction. And they confirmed that patients with a type 3 spinal cord shape had greater odds of intraoperative neuromonitoring loss. So inclusion of the spinal cord shape classification system in preoperative risk stratification and intraoperative management of spinal cord, a spinal deformity corrective surgery is recommended because it did predict the amount of neuromonitoring loss. And finally, the relative efficacy of available proteasome inhibitors in preventing muscle contractures following neonatal brachial plexus injury by Das et al. All of the tested second-generation proteasome inhibitors were able to reduce neonatal brachial plexus injury-induced contractures. So the nice part is that it showed a regulatory role of proteasomes in contracture formation. However, there really is a narrow dose range for efficacy for all proteasome inhibitors. And so it highlights the necessity of precise proteasome regulation for preventing contractures. Because it's such a narrow zone, you really need specialists to provide this. And finally, there's substantial toxicity stemming from proteasome inhibition, and it underscores the importance of identifying muscle-targeted strategies to suppress protein degradation and prevent contractures safely. There you have it. Lots of information there. Hope you enjoyed it, and hope you come along for our next run.
Yep. Don't forget to like and subscribe, get the notifications, listen to the back episodes. We'll still be putting cases on hold. Everything's on hold here. Hopefully your cases are good to go. Until we see you next time.